funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What influence have mind-altering drugs had on human culture, and how exactly do they change the workings of our brains? Given the evidence that even some animals seem to deliberately seek out substances that affect their perceptions and behavior, perhaps it should not surprise us that we have a long history of experimenting with consciousness-altering plants and chemicals. As Alfred Newton Richards Professor of Pharmacology at Northwestern University, Richard J. Miller is the ideal tour guide through this tandem story of science and history. He shares it in his new book, Drugged, The Science and Culture Behind Psychotropic Drugs. He joins us today from the studios of WTTW in Chicago. Richard, welcome to Think.
Hi there, Chris. Good afternoon.
Let's start with the basics. What exactly is a psychotropic drug?
Well, a psychotropic drug is any drug that has access to your brain and alters the way that the brain functions. So, you know, the main output of the brain really is your consciousness and your conscious experience. So psychotropic drugs, and there are many different types, and they do this in many different ways, but the basic feature to think about is that they alter the quality of your consciousness.
So they can be things as mild in their effect as caffeine and nicotine and things as intense in their effect as like LSD.
Absolutely. They really run the gamut. I mean, basically, most of us take psychotropic drugs at one time or another because we drink coffee, we drink tea, which have caffeine in it, obviously. But, you know, there are also much, much stronger drugs. Probably you mentioned one of the strongest, and that's LSD, which has very profound effects on, you know, conscious experience.
Is it possible to know, Richard, how long we humans have been deliberately seeking out drugs or things like drugs in order to feel different mentally?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of different types of evidence that this goes back a long, long time, much even before the, you know, writing started. Writing started approximately, let's say, around 3000 BC in Mesopotamia. And even at that time, I mean, if you look at the earliest writing, if you look at the word for a poppy in the Mesopotamian script and translate it directly into English, it translates as joy plant. So it's pretty obvious that even way back in, you know, ancient Mesopotamia, they knew a thing or two about poppies. But there's other evidence, which is, you know, more indirect, that goes back even further. And in particular, I mean, the kind of evidence I'm talking about is if you look at things like grave sites in Neolithic times or even pre-Neolithic times, you'll find the remains of poppy plants and also hemp. Hemp is cannabis. Mm-hmm. So those two drugs clearly have been used for, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. We don't obviously know what they were being used for just by finding the remains of these plants in grave sites. But, you know, the speculation is they were used for psychotropic purposes, absolutely.
And it seems likely that intoxicants might have played a role in the development of religion or at least religious symbolism.
Absolutely. There's a large literature on this, actually, and a great deal of speculation, some of which is more valuable than others. But we think that there are references to psychotropic drugs way back in the very most ancient texts that deal with religion. The Rig Veda, for example, which is one of the most ancient Hindu text, deals with psychotropic drugs. We think we know what they're talking about. It was probably a particular kind of mushroom. Also, the ancient text of Zoroastrianism also mentioned the use of psychotropic drugs. We also find, of course, that peoples that we encounter who are not technologically very sophisticated these days, for example, I mean, in the 20th century, there's been a lot of, you know, exploration in Mexico, going out to, you know, isolated villages where they've done things the same way for thousands and thousands of years. And we find that they use psychotropic drugs in their religious ceremonies quite a bit. In fact, when the Spanish conquistadors first came over to Central and South America, the Mexican Indians and South American Indians that they encountered had a very rich culture of using psychotropic drugs of different types in their religious ceremonies. I also would say that it sort of makes common sense. It's kind of a common sense argument that ancient peoples would have gone around and tried all the different plants and, you know, vegetables and fruits that were available in order to develop, you know, stable diets and agriculture. They certainly would have come across plants that contain psychotropic substances, and they would have felt their effects. And we can only imagine that this produced a kind of spiritual awareness in them at that time.
You have some wonderful reproductions in the book of drawings done by early people in various parts of the world that make it pretty clear that they had found mushrooms to be a pretty reliable influencer of their consciousness.
Yeah, there's very good evidence for the use of psychotropic mushrooms, both from two places, really, that are very interesting. One is Siberia and the tribes that existed in Siberia. And the other one, as I said, is Central America and South America. When the conquistadors, as I say, first came to Central America, they found people using mushrooms. These are mostly mushrooms that we call psilocybe mushrooms, from which you get the psychotropic drug psilocybin. And they have all kinds of wonderful statues and things of that kind, which are half human with mushrooms growing out of their heads. Also in Siberia, there's a long history of the use of Amanita muscaria, which is another psychotropic mushroom from which you get a drug called muscimol. And we find rock carvings in Siberia. And these rock carvings show, they're fantastic, actually. They show human beings with these enormous mushrooms sprouting out of their heads. They're fantastic. And so, you know, it's pretty clear that these things were very well integrated into these societies and used for religious purposes. And many of these societies have carried on doing this up to the present time.
And I gather, Richard, that these different mushrooms can have different chemical compounds within them, but typically they affect the neurotransmitters, and that's why they change the way we feel?
Right. So a bit of, if you'll bear with me, a bit of very basic science here. Mm-hmm. How do drugs work on the brain? Well, you know, the important cells in the brain, which we think are the ones that generate, you know, things like your conscious experience, are nerve cells, right? And nerve cells are constantly talking to each other. They talk to each other by using electrical signals. So the best way to think about it is this way. Drugs act upon nerve cells to change their activity, to make them talk more slowly or to make them talk more quickly. And the way a drug acts on a nerve cell is it interacts with a substance on the nerve cell called a receptor. And I think the easiest way to think about this is that receptor is like a lock. It looks like a lock. And normally that lock is closed. And when the drug comes along, it's like a key. And the key fits into that lock and it opens it up. And that allows the receptor to do something. Now, drugs do that, of course. But the question is, what's normally doing that when the drugs aren't around? And the answer is neurotransmitter molecules, because it's these neurotransmitter molecules that normally go about the business of the brain, allowing nerve cells to, you know, alter their conversation in quite complicated ways. And what these drugs do is to usurp the role of neurotransmitters and either make the neurotransmitter work better or make it work less effectively. And this is basically what they do. The receptors for different drugs are different. And they're also localized in different parts of the brain. And that's why different drugs produce different effects on the brain.
How did scientists try to understand the properties and the effects of psychotropic drugs in the era before we knew this much about the brain or even about the existence of something like neurotransmitters?
Well, the way that, for example, people in the pharmaceutical industry in the 19th century would test drugs, and this may seem obvious, actually, was they would try them on themselves and their friends. Mm-hmm. I mean, the most interesting story in this regard, I think, is the discovery of the drug that we call heroin. And you certainly will have heard of that, and all your listeners will have heard of heroin. It's a very, very addictive derivative of morphine. Well, this drug was discovered in the 19th century by the Bayer Drug Company in Germany. And they discovered it by trying a certain chemical reaction on morphine. They derived this new compound, which is actually, the chemical name is diacetylmorphine. And the man who tried it, he took some himself, and he said, "Oh my goodness, this makes me feel heroisch," which is the German for like very strong and powerful. So he said, "Oh great, so let's call it heroin." And that's how it got its name. So people would try drugs on themselves. They would try them on animals, of course. And before we knew about the brain in detail, we knew about the theory of neurotransmission, which only really got going in the early part of the 20th century. The only way to understand drugs scientifically was to try them on people and animals. Of course, there was a lot of understanding of drugs in a kind of spiritual and artistic sense, which is different. And experimentation in that went on for a long time before we knew about the science, of course.
Tell us about Albert Hofmann, who was the chemist who discovered LSD.
Oh, yes, Albert Hofmann. Well, this is a great story, actually. Albert Hofmann, who died a couple of years ago at the age of 102, was really one of the most important figures in the development of psychotropic drugs in the 20th century. He started as a young man working for the Sandoz Drug Company in Switzerland, and he was working on a group of compounds called ergot alkaloids. These are substances which come out of a fungus called ergot, which has very powerful psychotropic effects. And they gave him the job of trying to make a new drug that actually affected blood flow, was the thing he was looking at. He made a lot of chemical modifications to the substances that he found in ergot. He tried a lot of them on mice, and he didn't notice much at all. Then one day he was making a certain compound, and it was during the war. So in those days, all the cars in Switzerland were impounded because of the war, and you had to bicycle home to work. So he got on his bicycle, and he was bicycling home for his lunch, and he started to have all kinds of like weird hallucinations and things. He couldn't figure out what was going on. So he went back the next day. He thought, well, maybe it's this compound I was working on. But being Swiss, of course, he was unbelievably meticulous. And he couldn't have, taken a lot of it. He thought, well, maybe a tiny bit of it was underneath my nails or something like that. He went back and he deliberately took some of this compound, which was lysergic acid diethylamide, which is LSD. But the amount he took was based on the use of other ergots, and this was much more potent, actually. So he actually took like a heroically enormous dose of LSD, and it completely blew his mind. He tried to bicycle home with his technician. He had like a phenomenal trip, and he got over it, and he realized that he'd found something very interesting, and that's basically it.
My guest is Richard J. Miller. He's Alfred Newton Richards Professor of Pharmacology at Northwestern University and author of the new book, Drugged, The Science and Culture Behind Psychotropic Drugs. You can join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Richard J. Miller. He's Alfred Newton Richards Professor of Pharmacology at Northwestern University and author of Drugged, The Science and Culture Behind Psychotropic Drugs. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Richard, I would have never guessed before reading your book that the modern chemical and pharmaceutical industries had their origins in the production of fabric dyes. How did that all happen?
Yes, well, that's absolutely true. The pharmaceutical industry, which produces drugs which, you know, are modern chemical inventions rather than being, you know, things that we find in ancient graves and plants, started in the 19th century really with the rise of the science of organic chemistry. Organic chemistry allows us to take organic molecules and to change their structures. And we didn't really have this ability until really the middle of the 19th century. So what happened, the story is very interesting. In England, there was a young student called William Perkin, who got very interested in organic chemistry. And in those days, they used to give you homework, and you went home to your garage. Well, it wouldn't be a garage in those days, where they probably kept the horse or something like that. And he had a little laboratory, and he was trying to do his homework, and he did a chemical reaction which produced a beautiful purple color. And he was kind of a artistic fellow, actually. The color was very striking. He took it. He took the liquid out, and he tried staining cloth with it. He found that it stained the cloth very beautifully, and it held fast. That is, it didn't wash out. That's the important thing. So it was a proper dye. Before that time, all dyes came from natural sources. For example, indigo comes from a plant. Red dyes, purple dyes. They all came from natural products. They were very, very hard to obtain and very expensive. And there wasn't any synthetic dye stuffs at all. Well, Perkin had the wonderful idea that that's exactly what he'd made. He'd made a synthetic chemical dye. And he looked at the color. It was a nice pinky purple color. And there was a French flower called the mallow flower. And so he took from that the word mauve. And so this was the origin of the dye called mauve. Now, at that time, because of Perkin's work, a lot of companies started to get set up, particularly in Great Britain and Germany, to start synthesizing dye stuffs of one kind or another. And that became rather a big industry. So we had a nascent, chemical industry at that time. Then what happened was some people at the chemical industries started to test some of the derivatives of dye stuffs that they found on animals and on humans to see if they had other properties as well. And again, it was the Bayer company in Germany found that some of their dye stuff derivatives had very good properties at reducing fever, which was obviously an important thing. They came up with a drug called phenacetin. And then gradually, a lot of these companies switched from being dye-making companies to pharmaceutical companies. And most of the large companies like Bayer, BASF, several other companies, Hoechst, Merck and things, many of these companies, in Europe at any rate, started as dye-making companies.
So how did drugs and chemical compounds that started in labs as the property of drug companies, things like heroin and LSD, transition to being street drugs?
Well, it's hard to keep the genie in the bottle, as they say. These things have a habit of taking on a life of their own. Heroin's a good example. Actually, it's really very interesting because the Bayer company actually put two drugs on the market exactly in 1898, two new drugs. One was heroin and the other was aspirin. So I think it's amazing that they – in fact, there are advertisements, and some of them I show in my book, where you've got flyers and ads where they are advertising our two great new drugs, heroin and aspirin. Now, heroin originally was not even thought to be addictive. It was considered to be a non-addictive substitute for morphine. big mistake.
Yeah.
And it was sold as a cough suppressant because, you know, opiates are used. They have a very, they're very useful drugs as well as affecting pain. They are very good cough suppressants. Mm-hmm. And heroin came to America as a cough suppressant. So it was very easily available. And people could get hold of it. There weren't any laws saying, you know, you couldn't go and buy some and take it. Of course, what happened is that fairly rapidly, heroin addicts started to appear on the streets of New York. It's an interesting story, actually, because just as heroin addicts today, they needed money to buy heroin and get supplies of their drug. And they noticed that lying around New York, there was a lot of junk and, you know, old bedsteads and things like that. And they collected this and they resold it to get money for to buy more heroin. And so they became known as junkies. That's where the word junkie comes from. But I mean, it's not difficult for, I mean, there's the same story you ask about LSD. I mean, LSD also came to America. It was originally very freely available. The Sandoz Drug Company distributed it very widely. And so it wasn't hard to, you know, for people to get hold of these things and to find out what they did. It's just not difficult at all.
Let's go to the phones now. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Brady on the line in Arlington. Hi, Brady.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
I was wondering if your guest could comment towards, similar to how the drugs appear on the street as recreational drugs, surely that influences modern pharmacologists to, like, censor a little bit of what they publish out of fears that their discoveries will be abused.
Right. Yes. How do we do that? I mean, when you publish, when you do experiments in a laboratory at a very basic level, it's hard to know sometimes what the ultimate use of these things will be. To take that example of heroin, the people that made it in the first place, they thought it was going to be a great cough suppressant, and I'm sure they would be absolutely horrified to find out that it had become a street drug of that type. I mean, the NIH does have programs which seek to synthesize new substances which will, you know, produce the beneficial effects of drugs and be free of their, you know, their serious side effects. So, for example, the holy grail, if you like, would be to try and make a drug that's like morphine and has all the wonderful effects of morphine on pain and on cough and on diarrhea, all the other things it's used for, but was free of its addictive liability. Similarly, I mean, you can think of a drug like nicotine. Nicotine is very good for some things, for example, increasing your ability to concentrate and be aware of things. But again, it's very addictive. So, I mean, we are, scientists are, and the pharmaceutical industry and the government are aware of these problems. And there are efforts to try and use modern chemical techniques to actually make new substances which you know, are free of the problems that we have with other substances. But, you know, we can't take those substances, and we talked about the genie in the bottle. We can't put the genie back in the bottle for substances that are already out there. That can't be done. But we try and improve on these things. That's the best approach, I think.
All right, let's talk about marijuana. We know that the plant grows wild in a number of different parts of the world. In this country specifically, it hadn't really been widely used and abused, and yet in the early part of the 20th century, people got really sort of panicky about the effect it might have on people.
Marijuana, that's a great topic, actually. There's a lot of misinformation as well as good information about marijuana. What happened there is very interesting. I mean, hemp, Indian hemp, or cannabis as it was called, was available in the United States. There's a wonderful story written by Louisa May Alcott, you know, who wrote Little Women, about two people falling in love over the use of hashish-laced candy. So, I mean, that tells you just how, you know, totally, you know, middle class this whole thing was. And it wasn't called marijuana either. What happened was when the Federal Bureau of Narcotics began in the early part of the 20th century, there was a fellow called Harry Anslinger who headed this. And he was, I think, politically ambitious in some perhaps not particularly savory ways. He needed a hot button issue to show that the Federal Bureau of Narcotics could save the American people from some terrible menace and do something useful. Now, at that time, there were a lot of Mexican immigrant workers in the southern part of the U.S. who had initially come here and were very welcome, but then the Depression was coming in and these people were seen as, you know, taking away jobs from Americans and things. These people, a lot of the workers did use cannabis and they had a Spanish name for it, which was marijuana. So he stopped calling it cannabis and started calling it marijuana and started associating it with, you know, people like migrant Mexican workers, and started to make up all kinds of like incredible things about it. I mean, really, it's hard to believe that people really believe some of the things he said. I mean, he would say things like, if you took one whiff of marijuana, it would turn you into a mass murderer, and make up all kinds of stories. I mean, there were these fantastic movies like Reefer Madness, if you've ever seen that one. It's absolutely brilliant. I mean, it was really a political issue. There was very little truth. I mean, marijuana has its good and bad side that we can debate. I'm happy to talk about that. But the casting of marijuana as the devil drug was back in the 1920s and 30s. That was definitely a completely political move on the part of Harry Anslinger. And there's simply no doubt about that. And it's very interesting how that whole story developed, actually.
So you mentioned in the book the fact that George Washington had a significant hemp plantation on his property. We have an email here from Brian who says, my daughter told me about a note from Washington to Thomas Jefferson saying he recommended some hemp seeds he'd gotten. Could the founding fathers have been potheads?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Benjamin Franklin, you know, was into absolutely everything. So I'm sure that Benjamin Franklin probably experimented with things. But generally speaking, I don't think they were. The hemp plant is really a fantastically useful plant. I mean, it's a tall, gangling kind of weed. And the stem of the plant is very fibrous. And it's used to make hemp cloth and canvas. In fact, the word canvas comes from the word cannabis. So it's been used a lot for making material of that kind, and it was widely grown in the United States, at Mount Vernon and all kinds of other places, but I think probably primarily for its use in making hemp cloth. Whether they smoked it or not, I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't know. Good story in the making there, but no evidence, I'm afraid.
Have you been able to isolate why we have continued to see alcohol as a socially acceptable drug when almost anything else that can intoxicate us is really frowned upon in our culture?
Well, I think it's just a historical accident, actually. I mean, alcohol is something that has been used as a recreational psychotropic drug in Western societies for such a long time. It's very hard to get rid of it. Don't forget, I mean, we did try and get rid of alcohol in this country. We did have prohibition. It wasn't a success. It's just so ingrained in our society that it's really an exception. We've made a special place for alcohol. There really aren't any strong psychotropic drugs apart from alcohol which are used quite as freely. I mean, nicotine is used as well, but it doesn't have the really, you know, it can't produce the violent effects that alcohol has. So alcohol's really a special case, and I think it's a historical accident, actually.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Franklin on the line in Arlington. Hello, Franklin.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well.
I have kind of a double question. First is just how do you feel, or have you ever heard about the theory of consciousness, more that the brain does not create consciousness, but consciousness is more received like a signal from a TV set, and when the brain dies off, consciousness does not cease to exist. And also the role of dimethyltryptamine being contained in every human brain on this planet. And I don't know how that ties into our understanding of these drugs and consciousness.
Any thoughts, Richard?
Yes, lots. I mean, you got 3 hours. We can maybe start answering that question. Well, what is consciousness? How does the brain produce it? And does the brain actually produce it, or are we receiving it from KERA? I don't know how to answer that. That's a very good question. I don't think I can answer that really. I mean, the most prevalent theory, and this is the theory, is that the complexity of electrical interactions that the brain produces results in a phenomenon called consciousness. And it's a property that results from the electrical complexity of the brain. That's the most popular theory. I think it's not really clear that that's absolutely correct and that there isn't some other, you know, property or explanation for consciousness. NN-dimethyltryptamine that you talk about is a substance that can in and of itself alter people's consciousness. Chemical compounds like NN-dimethyltryptamine do occur in the brain, and they do act as neurotransmitters, actually. So there are substances that we normally have in our brain that probably affect consciousness in a similar way to NN-dimethyltryptamine. But we also have substances in our brain that actually work like cannabis. They're called endocannabinoids, so they may also have similar effects.
Richard J. Miller is with us. He's professor of pharmacology at Northwestern University, and he has a new book out called Drugged, The Science and Culture Behind Psychotropic Drugs. You can join us by sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Richard J. Miller, who's professor of pharmacology at Northwestern University and author of the new book Drugged, The Science and Culture Behind Psychotropic Drugs. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Richard, it seems that the middle part of the 20th century was all about tranquilizers. Can you talk about how these were developed, what they were intended to do, and the surprises that they had in store for people who became addicted to them?
Well, yes. I would say that there was a period in the middle of the 20th century, starting around 1950, which I'd like to describe as the psychopharmacological revolution, because that's the time where we first made drugs which were useful for diseases like schizophrenia. So we call those antipsychotic drugs that were used for treating depression. So we call those antidepressants, or for anxiety. So we call those anti-anxiety or anxiolytic agents. So these don't come from ancient times. All these drugs come from the development of the pharmacological industry, pharmaceutical industry, which we were talking about a few moments ago, which itself developed from the science of organic chemistry and dye making. The antipsychotic drugs are a very interesting story. They followed the route which I described before. There were dyes that were made at various companies in Germany, They were tested in animals, and some of them were found to have some interesting effects. And then one of them, which was a substance called chlorpromazine, which originally was sold as under the name Thorazine, this was eventually tested by somebody actually in Tunisia who was doing surgery. And he noticed, he tested it for completely different reasons, but he noticed it made people who were going to surgery a lot more together and sort of calmer. And clearly it had some kind of effect on their nervous system. So people started to try this drug on various patients of various types, particularly people who had a lot of what people call psychoagitation, which is kind of an old-fashioned word for some of the symptoms of schizophrenia, you know, psychotic disorders. And they found very rapidly that this drug calmed these people down, and so this became the first antipsychotic drug. Similarly, there were developments of antidepressant drugs. That has a slightly different story, if I can go back a moment.
Sure.
To tell you that, because it's actually a fascinating story. But again, it came out of the development of something else in the pharmaceutical industry. And that story starts this way. In the Second World War, you probably know that the Germans used to fire V2 rockets over to London to terrorize the population. They had these V1 rockets, V2 rockets. They were sent out from a base on the Baltic Sea called Peenemünde. And after the war, the Allies captured Peenemünde. They went in there. There was a lot of, you know, old rockets lying around. There's a lot of rocket fuel. And the main ingredient in this rocket fuel was something called hydrazine. And it's a very reactive chemical. So they had a lot of this stuff. They dumped it on the American chemical market very cheap. And pharmaceutical companies started to use it to make various things. The thing they made first, or one of the things they made first, was drug for tuberculosis, which was a very good drug. And they started testing this. There was a famous trial where they tested this anti-tuberculosis drug on some patients in a tuberculosis clinic, and they got a lot better. But they noticed that their mood improved, probably improved because they were getting better. But it was beyond that, and eventually it became clear that this drug had an effect on mood by itself, and it became the first antidepressant drug. There are similar stories I could tell you about the development of anxiolytic drugs like, you know, Valium and drugs like that. But all these things were part of this burgeoning, you know, organic chemistry, pharmaceutical industry in the middle part of the 20th century, and a lot of substances were developed at that time. Really, the decades between 1950 and 1980 were the really revolutionary times in the development of tranquilizers and antidepressants of all kinds.
And many of those drugs have made an extraordinary difference for people who before suffered from what were essentially incurable illnesses.
Yes, it's amazing. I mean, when I say the psychopharmacology revolution, it was a revolution in medicine. I mean, I don't remember the exact figures, but there's something like this. I mean, the number of people with psychotic illness in the night before the development of chlorpromazine in American hospitals was something like 500,000. And after using chlorpromazine for a number of years, many of these patients were treated as outpatients. And the number of inpatients fell to, you know, 50,000 or something like that. You know, 90% of people were then treated as outpatients with a drug that helps many of them. It certainly doesn't help all of them, but it helps a lot of them. So this was a revolution in medicine. It was, if you could use the word, a paradigm shift in the way these patients were treated. They weren't stuck in mental hospitals anymore, but they were treated as outpatients with medicines that were at least somewhat effective.
Let's go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. John's on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you?
Very well,
hey.
Thank you.
Terrific topic. I love this. So I was wondering, or actually, really quick comment. I was going to say that I think it's great that Mr. Miller is talking about the history of drugs and civilization, because especially with the reemergence of marijuana coming, it's not going to go away. And I think that people need to know a history of things, because I don't think the drugs are going to go away anytime soon. Well, the quick question is that, is it possible, you mentioned that the history of civilizations, Mesopotamia had hemp and they had all these different other substances, that when humans migrated around the world, when they brought their food with themselves, or they brought their drugs with themselves, and introduced it to other cultures, could it be that other cultures are not adequately, or can they have a negative effect to these different substances, and maybe an aversion because they're just not used to, around these substances? Like, for example, Native Americans may not be able to take alcohol as Caucasians, right, or even vice versa.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think there's a tremendous amount of cross-cultural influence and cross-cultural pollution of this type. I mean, I can think of a large number of examples of this kind of thing. Let's take cocaine, for example. I mean, cocaine was used for thousands of years by people in Peru and South America. They chew coca leaves, and when they chew coca leaves, they get pretty beneficial effects on their appetite, on their ability to work long hours, on their ability to work at high altitudes. And so this was, you know, very widely used. But when cocaine came to the United States, it came in a different way. First of all, it was purified, right? So you had crystalline, pure cocaine. Also, people had invented the hypodermic syringe, so you could inject it directly into your bloodstream. And the kind of effects you'd get of a drug like cocaine in the context of American society were very, very different from what, you know, endogenous peoples who took it for thousands of years in Peru would have experienced. And it's simply inappropriate for use in that kind of society. So because of the technology that's available in different societies, because of the form that the drug is actually, its chemical form, and because of the way the society functions, what is okay in one society is not necessarily okay in another society. And there are many examples of this kind of thing.
So leave it to human ingenuity to take something that has a mild effect and really demand more and more and more and concentrate the power of the thing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, you know, most of the drugs that indigenous peoples used were used in a crude form. I mean, opium is what you get out of a poppy. In opium, there are two psychoactive drugs. They are morphine and codeine. The percentage of opium that's actually morphine or codeine is like less than, maybe it's something of the order of 1%. So, you know, when you take it as a pure substance, it's hundreds of times more powerful than when you smoke regular opium. And as I say, technology is always important. And another big breakthrough in the whole history of drug taking was in 1853, a Scottish doctor called Alexander Wood invented the hypodermic syringe. And that enabled people to inject drugs directly into their bloodstream. So, yeah, I mean, I think that wasn't, you know, invented for a bad purpose. And there are many reasons why injecting drugs is very beneficial. But, you know, people will use the technology to for whatever ends that come up. And some of them, in terms of the use of drugs, have been very unfortunate.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Anne on the line in Richardson. Hi, Anne.
Yeah, hi there. What I love about nitrous oxide is that you immediately return to normal when it stops. So why couldn't it be used for end-of-life pain and anxiety?
I don't know if
nitrous oxide. I mean, why? You mean for euthanasia or for just treating people with? Well, I mean, I think that the problem with nitrous oxide is that it is a very transient kind of effect, and you have to keep taking it, so it's a little impractical to use it over laughing gas, to use it over long periods of time, but it's certainly the case that people are interested in using other kinds of psychotropic drugs which have, you know, somewhat similar effects but last longer as end-of-life panaceas, if you like. I mean, there's a story of Aldous Huxley. You know, Aldous Huxley's famous writer who wrote Brave New World, and who was very interested in psychotropic drugs and psychotropic drug culture. He insisted that as he lay dying on his bed that his wife injected him with LSD. And she did that, and as he was dying, he went off into the hereafter under the influence of LSD. So I think the idea that you have to use drugs in that way, that has been around, and I think some people do actually employ it. Whether the actual substance that you mention is practical to use in that way, I sort of doubt that's all that practical. But the idea is definitely something to think about, yeah.
Are there a great deal of improvements on the horizon for the psychotropics that we've developed that do help people with bona fide mental health problems?
Well, that's a good question. Basically, the pharmaceutical industry has been pretty stuck since the late 80s with improving the antipsychotic and antidepressant and anti-anxiety drugs that we have. The improvements have been relatively small. There are always drugs on the horizon in the pipeline which look very exciting and might, you know, have improvements of one kind or another. Whether they actually finally reach the marketplace is always difficult. Most drugs that come through pharmaceutical companies don't eventually get on the market for one reason or another. But there are, you know, plenty of things like that. But we need some breakthroughs in those fields to make, you know, new approaches with drugs, because we've been using the same drugs for, you know, around 50 years now, and it's time to, many of them for 50 years, it's time to move on a bit. So we desperately need things like that. I would also say that some of the drugs which we're not legally allowed to use may also be the source of some interesting things if scientists were allowed to actually use these things in experiments. But because of the laws, they're very hard to get hold of and they're very hard to do experiments with.
What kinds of drugs are those?
Well, I mean, things like LSD, ecstasy, you know, marijuana as well, although marijuana, the laws are clearly changing. But, you know, drugs that have very powerful effects on the brain, like LSD, like ecstasy, they are Schedule I drugs, which mean that even scientists are really, it's very, very hard for us to obtain those drugs to do experiments. But the thing that's always fascinated me about these substances is if you take a substance like LSD, you can take micrograms of this drug and it has enormous effects on your conscious experience, and they're extremely profound. And it seems to me that if we could really, you know, do more experimentation with substances like that, it would tell us all kinds of important and useful things about how the brain works. But unfortunately, you know, we're not really allowed to do that at the moment.
Richard J. Miller is Alfred Newton Richards Professor of Pharmacology at Northwestern University and author of Drugged, The Science and Culture Behind Psychotropic Drugs. He joined us today from the studios of WTTW in Chicago. Richard, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.